You're with SBS Radio. Find more great stories in your language at sbs.com.au.
I'm joined by Tom Murray, the writer and director of the movie The Skin of Others, premiering on SBS World Movies on January 25. The Skin of Others tells the story of modern Australia told through the extraordinary life of Aboriginal World War I soldier Douglas Grant. Douglas Grant was a famous man in his day at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. He was a bridge between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. But director Tom Murray best describes Douglas Grant as a sort of Forrest Gump figure. Now, Tom Murray, first of all, welcome to NITV Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'll start by quoting one of your lines where you explain the making of the film. You say the making of this film was like doing a collage of pieces that would never fit together. That's a good description of how Douglas Grant's story is intriguing and so intricate that piecing it together was an extraordinary journey in some little known or little talked about corners of Australia's history.
Australian history, as you know, has gone through big kind of revisions over the last 20, 30 years as people, as historians and as kind of the wider community have finally tried to grapple with some of the elements of our national history that it would have been preferred from a white perspective not to have talked about. So you've covered a whole lot of stuff on the frontier wars in Wiradjuri country and other places, and the whole notion of the colonial frontier wars has for such a long time just been hidden, and you know, that whole kind of idea of the white blindfold view of history that was really the dominant view of history. And the moment you start to kind of address some of those things and peel back some of the stories from 100 years ago, 150 years ago and so on, then a very different picture appears of Australian nationhood. And Douglas Grant's story is one of those ones where it's almost so extraordinary, it's unbelievable. And the story kind of comes together in fragments. There's a bit that we know from here and a bit we know from there. And when you put that together with the general kind of fragmented nature of Australian history storytelling, then, yeah, what I was left with when I was trying to make this film was a sort of collage of pieces. And as you'll kind of get when you watch the film, there was other circumstances that meant that there was unfinished aspects of the film. So it was kind of, it was like a jigsaw where some of the pieces didn't kind of match the spaces that were left. So I had to pull it together from these fragments.
Yeah, and it's also because the history of Australia, the way it was told, we've got two sides. We've got the storytelling from the Aboriginal side, and the stories are transmitted from one generation to another orally, whereas on the other side, it's a written Western way of storytelling. But and sometimes this kind of storytelling also kind of presents a certain angle to whitewash or to misrepresent, I don't know, to tell the story from another perspective. So you've got two different perspectives. Quite a hard work to bring all this together in something coherent.
Trying to make it coherent. Like I think in some ways, in the end, I didn't really bother too much with making it totally coherent. I thought that it would be good to leave some of that, you know, that slightly kind of angular, you know, collage aspect in there, because for me that sort of represents the way as a nation we've attempted to pull together this story. You know, it's been from all these different these pieces that sometimes don't quite fit. And exactly as you've said, we've had huge long periods of denial of how Australia was founded. You know, this idea that Australia was founded in this sort of relatively benign way, and which we now know is totally untrue, that there were massive wars across the whole of Australia where sovereign nations fought for their rights to land that had been in families for so many millennia, 50 millennia, 60 millennia, and that it, this was a violent period. And Douglas Grant, who's the central character of the film, The Skin of Others that I made, his life straddles such a violent time. Like, he was born in far north Queensland, and the frontier wars got to North Queensland, to his part of the country. He was from the rainforest nations up on the Atherton Tableland, and the frontier sort of got there in the 1870s, 1880s. So he was born in 1885, and there was a massacre in his country that was probably in about 1887, where he became orphaned from that event. And at the time, like in 1915, 1916, when people were writing about that in terms of Douglas Grant's own story, because he kind of became famous when he went to fight in the First World War, they described that as a, inverted commas, tribal disturbance, because at that point, the native police, the native mounted police in some cases, had lots of Aboriginal people serving in those forces. And so the colonial kind of powers that be described the massacre that happened in North Queensland because of the presence of native police as a tribal disturbance or a tribal war, which isn't what it was at all. It was actually a colonial war of occupation. And so Douglas Grant is one of these incredible stories, incredible characters, because his life was totally defined by the two major wars of the 18th to 19th century, the 20th century here in Australia, the frontier wars of Australian occupation that we know not so much about. I mean, we know more about it over the last decade or two. And the First World War, in which Douglas Grant fought and was initially enlisted and passed the sergeant's exam, an Aboriginal man who passed the sergeant's exam and was going to go to war, the First World War, as a sergeant. He eventually shipped as an infantryman in 1915. But his life is completely defined by these huge global wars. I mean, colonialism was a global war of occupation, as we know. It had its different variations in different nations across the globe, but that came to the, till that point, relatively peaceful area of far north Queensland, where Douglas Grant's life had family had presumably lived for many generations. And then suddenly we have this man who, or this child, Douglas Grant, and he's orphaned, and he's adopted by a couple of people working for the Australian Museum, who are collecting museum specimens just around the edges of where these massacres were happening, and sending them down to the Australian Museum in Sydney. And they fostered Douglas Grant and brought him down to Sydney. So from the time of 1887, Douglas came down to Sydney and was brought up in a white family, eventually living in suburban Annandale in the heart of Sydney.
Going back to the beginning of his life, you said he was adopted. He was actually found and adopted by his white Scottish parents. But again, comes this problem of recounting the stories, because if he was orphaned as a baby, he wouldn't be able to tell the story because he was maybe too young. And then the stories that he might pass on, we get just little bits and pieces that we may not know. We would know very well the side of his white parents, but for his Aboriginal side, we wouldn't know much about it.
No, it's tragic in the sense that Douglas was probably only, I mean, the child who became christened Douglas by the white Grant family, of course. He was only two or three when he came down to Sydney, and I think, you know, I mean, most of us, we probably only remember things as adults from the time we're five or six, so, and that would have been a hugely traumatic event as well. So, he didn't really remember anything of his origins, you know, in far north Queensland. And as far as we know, he never went back to North Queensland, to the Atherton Tablelands area, even though that on his birth certificate it says that he was born on the Atherton Tablelands. I think it even says Atherton as the town. And we think he probably was from an area around Atherton, Malanda, up there on the Tablelands, but he never went back. And, you know, I thought that that would have been a big kind of loss for Douglas, not having that heritage, not growing up in that community.
Yeah, and then he would go on to lead an extraordinary life, navigating both worlds. And you also mentioned that he had a very strong Scottish accent, and which you could actually switch on and off at will. And then he also went to become the first Aboriginal sergeant in the Imperial Army. Was it even Imperial Army? How would you call the army at that time? Was it the Australian Army at the time? Was it the Imperial Army? How would you call it?
Yeah, I think it was called the AIF, Australian Imperial Forces. He was a sergeant. He passed the sergeant's exam. In 1915, he was working at as a wool classer around the Scone area for the family, actually, of Patrick White, the novelist, who have a farm out there at Bell Trees. And he was out there working as a shearer, and he must have felt like it was his patriotic duty to go and fight in the war, as some of his other colleagues would have decided. So in 1915, he went to Scone and signed up, and he was a smart guy, a really smart guy. And he'd had pretty good schooling. He'd gone to Annandale Primary School, and he'd been a draftsman working at Mort Stock there in Balmain. So he was a very kind of skilled, literate, smart guy, and his Scottish adopted family kind of would have grown him up with Shakespeare and the poetry of Robbie Burns and all that kind of stuff, of which he took it all in, and he could perfectly replicate the accents of his parents, who were from kind of the Motherwell region just near Edinburgh there in the south of Scotland. So he could put on a Scots accent whenever he wanted, and he could play the bagpipes, and he could read and orate as Robbie Burns' poems, and he was could have been the life and soul of parties. Like when the Australian Museum, fellows from the Australian Museum were later talking about some of their kind of soirees in the evening, then Douglas Grant would get up and perform there. So he was completely encultured into that Scottish family, and with all the kind of cultural references that they would have had, and as a scholar, he was exceptional. So it's no surprise that he passed the exam to become a sergeant. And we don't exactly know why he was stripped of that. Having become a sergeant in the army, one theory is that he would have been marching in the very first Anzac Day march through Sydney, and if he marched there as an Aboriginal man and as a sergeant in a kind of pride of place as a sergeant, then potentially that the optics of that in a deeply racist society in 1915 were such that the powers that be deemed that they couldn't have an Aboriginal man as a serving officer, and he was stripped of his rank, which seems like a very plausible scenario to me at that point, in the racism that he would have been part of. I suppose it's even more surprising that he could have performed at such an elite level, given the racism that was surrounding him.
Yeah, and it says in the movie he was switched, his records were switched from the 34th to the 13th Regiment, and then his rank kind of administratively, he was demoted. How did he navigate this kind of situation with such an overt act of racism?
Yeah, I mean, we can only speculate, can't we? I mean, it must have been devastating when you know how capable you are, and you've proved it. You've proved it. You've passed the exam. You have a whole bunch of peers that acknowledge your capacity as a leader, and then you know it's because of the colour of your skin, it's because of the racism of the time, that you're not given the opportunities that you deserve. And that's one of the often Douglas Grant's story is told as tragedy, and it's told as a kind of personal tragedy that somehow Douglas Grant was not capable of surviving at that point, at that time. And we're jumping ahead here. Subsequently, he did have a nervous breakdown after he's come back from war. But to jump back to that time in 1915, I think what that shows is absolutely the tragedy of the society that he was brought up in. It's not a tragedy about Douglas Grant. It's a tragedy about racism. And I think that is the real illustration of that, how Douglas Grant coped Well, he went to war, and he was distinguished in war. So he managed to, you know, be resilient enough to prosper despite those circumstances. But I think it's perfectly illustrative of the tragedy of racism at that point in time.
Despite that incident in 1916, he ended up going to war in France and was even captured by the Germans.
Yeah, well, he was part of the First Battle of Bullecourt. And so on the 11th of April 1917, a huge amount of the Allied soldiers, a large Australian contingent, went at Bullecourt and tried to cross the line that had been put in place by the Germans there. And it was a completely disastrous conflict at that point. Something like 50% of all of the Australians who participated were casualties of that. It was just a monumental mistake. They just kind of ran. It was snowing on that day, and they just were completely mown down by the German fire. And Douglas Graham was wounded, and he was one of the last men fighting in the snow on that day. And he was captured by the Germans, and he was sent to a couple of prisoner of war camps where he was in the first case, in the first prisoner of war camp. They had them all on basically malnutrition diets. They weren't giving them enough food, and they were making the soldiers like a human shield. They were putting them between the German and the Allied lines so that they were in real jeopardy. And so Douglas Grant apparently lost a lot of weight, and like a lot of the men at that point would have been in those camps. But then he got sent eventually to another prisoner of war camp near Berlin called Wunstorf. And one of the reasons he was sent to Wunstorf was that there was a couple of really curious experiments that the Germans were doing at the time. One was scientific and one was imperial. And the scientific experiment was because in the middle of the First World War, the Germans, like all the different powers, had a whole lot of scholars that were not being able to do the work that they'd traditionally done, you know, linguists, anthropologists, musicologists. And they realized that in the prisoner of war camps across Germany, there was millions of soldiers, many of whom were from the British and French colonial territories fighting for the Allies, and that they could study them. And Douglas Grant, as an Aboriginal man from Australia, was thought to be a pretty interesting anthropological specimen. So he's sent to Wunstorf, where he was studied. And that's another huge and incredible event that Douglas Grant was part of.
Douglas Grant seemed to go through these horrific experiences almost scot-free. He really went through some terrible things, yet continued to navigate both worlds, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal lives, smoothly. But how did he really manage to do this so effortlessly? And was he really unscathed by what he went through?
Douglas Grant was the subject of those experiments in 1918. We know that he was the subject of the experiments because there's records being kind of kept from the Royal Prussian Phonographic Commission that was part of the scientific commission that was studying him. So there was a sculpture, and I found the sculpture. There was a sculpture made of him. He was painted. They tried to establish if he had any language, Aboriginal language words, which he didn't. And then 1919, the war ends, and Douglas Grant was sent back to Australia. And like a lot of Aboriginal men, again, we have to face the profound racism of the early 20th century Australian state, where lots of returned soldiers, as we know, white soldiers, were given soldier settlements and given blocks of country from across Australia, and that was granted by the government. And the profound kind of double tragedy of that, of course, particularly from an Aboriginal perspective like Douglas Grant's, was that up to 1,000 Aboriginal men fought in the First World War, as we know. They didn't get those soldier settlements. And not only did they not get those soldier settlements into the bargain, some of their country was given to the other soldiers. It was a real nasty sting in the tail of having served for the colonial state at that point. And Douglas Grant, like other Aboriginal men, was not given his fair share of the colonial state's spoils of war, of acknowledgement of their service. But yet, and here again, Grant demonstrates what an incredible character he was. He didn't fall completely into the bitterness of all of that, as one could be very easily inclined to do. Instead, he embarked through the mid-1920s on a career as a journalist, like writing articles and going around to town halls and giving speeches. We know that he's giving speeches to the Balmain Town Hall. He's giving speeches to the Sydney Town Hall. He had a job back up in Lithgow. He was the representative of the diggers in Lithgow, and he was fighting for trade union rights and labour rights and so on behalf of his fellow returned soldiers. And so he became an activist and a journalist through the 1920s. He didn't kind of let the obvious racism that was all around and impacting many of his peers and indeed himself. He sustained himself and was resilient enough to try to fight for better conditions for his fellow soldiers, white and black, and for Aboriginal people.
So Douglas Grant came back to Australia, spent some time in different places, including La Perouse, around Sydney's eastern suburbs. And this is a place where actually some returned servicemen were offered plots of land in recognition for their service. Well, this kind of unfairness might have influenced his work, or at least his outlook on life.
Yeah, I mean, how totally unfair, and what a response. So in 1928, one of the kind of dreadful instances of colonial violence flared up in the Northern Territory, a massacre of Aboriginal men, women and children at a place called Coniston. This was 1928, and Douglas Grant wrote a really fiery piece of journalism saying that, you know, this is completely inappropriate for a nation state like Australia. This is disgraceful. Ordinary Australians are not aware of what's going on. Human rights are being violated. And so he wrote a really, really powerful piece for a major Sydney Sunday newspaper that would have had a big circulation at the time. Professor John Maynard, who's in the film, talks about how that would have been, you know, obviously a very brave thing to have done, but it would have marked Douglas Grant as being a problem for the state. Aboriginal activists of the 1920s and the 1930s suffered heavily at the hands of the colonial state. John Maynard talks about his own grandfather, who was also an activist in the 20s, and the police coming around and harassing him and saying, you know, we know where you live and we know who your children are, and basically saying, if you don't shut up, then there's going to be some severe consequences. So it's easier enough, I mean, I'm a white fella, it's easy enough from this position, 2021, to try to imagine what the stakes are for someone like Douglas Grant back then, but it would have been profound. Like, it was incredible act of bravery to write the kind of things that he was writing at the time.
Yeah, there's a period in Douglas Grant's life when he kind of disappeared from public life, and his legacy would only be remembered posthumously in an ABC broadcast several decades later.
That's right. So Douglas Grant, from being such a fierce advocate for Aboriginal rights in the late 1920s and giving many public orations about the unfairness of the colonial administration in various ways in dealing with Aboriginal people, he suffered a breakdown in the early 1930s, and he went to Callan Park Hospital. He was in Callan Park Hospital for the next kind of decade. So he was in there from the 30s till the beginning of the 30s till the end of the 1930s. I think there was a lot going on. Both his adoptive parents had died. So, you know, Douglas, I think, was in need of some respite and in need of some secure lodgings. So he stayed in the military arm of Callan Park, Ward B, which is where the other returned servicemen who were suffering kind of shell shock and post-traumatic stress from that period also stayed. Then he kind of had a very kind of quiet, relatively quiet life in the 1940s, and he died in the early 1950s. He was down at, as you said, down at the kind of Return Services League at La Perouse. There's a place down out there on the island, and he was there, and he died of a heart attack in the early 50s. And because he'd had such an incredible life and been such a figure of great esteem to many who knew him, in 1958, John Thompson and Brian Hungerford, John Thompson being the father of Jack and Peter Thompson, Jack Thompson the actor, Peter Thompson the film critic, John Thompson did a really amazing radio documentary about Douglas Grant, and kind of consolidated his kind of posthumous fame by recounting the different kind of aspects of his life. And he was really a figure that provoked a lot of interest because of the way that he navigated the different worlds, white and black. And many of his kind of comrades said that because he'd been encultured by the Scottish family, he was like a white fella in their midst, but he obviously had a very strong kind of sense of his own Aboriginality and in the way that he was advocating for his own people. So he was one of these really interesting figures that people were trying to kind of get their heads around. And so that was a nationally kind of broadcast documentary in the 50s and would have consolidated his fame at the time. But he sort of went out of the public imagination after that, little bits and pieces, but he's certainly not as well known as many other figures, and he's certainly not as well known, in my view, as he should be for all of his profound work.
Now, the movie The Skin of Others sheds a light on Douglas Grant's legacy, and I believe will elevate him to the place where he ought to be. He deserves to be remembered as one of Australia's greatest and brightest minds.
Yeah, I hope so. It's like we're very kind of strongly in mind of preserving his legacy and revitalizing his legacy. And Balang Lewis, who many will know from his incredible acting career across many films, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith being his first film, Balang Lewis plays Douglas Grant in my documentary. And he really, really took to this role. It was a role he felt very close to and very dear to, because I think a big part of Balang's kind of public life was trying to come to some agreement between, you know, his own sense of Aboriginality and his own sense of his white heritage as well. So Balang Lewis was very keen to demonstrate Douglas Grant's incredible legacy. And the film is also, for those of you that will get to see it, is also a sort of homage to Balang Lewis as an incredible actor. He very much gets into the skin of Douglas Grant, and his great sense of imagination and empathy really brings Douglas Grant's story to light and to life, I think.
I've had a chance to preview the movie. It's full of archival documents, beautiful photographs, and other pieces. Was it easy to access them? Must have been a really painstaking job gathering these documents.
Well, the film took 10 years to make, and it was took 10 years to make because while there was some stuff that was out there in the public domain, a lot of it wasn't. And I tried to spend a long time trying to find Douglas's family in far north Queensland. So there's a big chunk of the film which is set in far north Queensland with different members of the Rainforest Nations up there, the Najon, the Mamor, people like Ernie Raymond, Uncle Ernie Raymond, who's interviewed in the film, talks about what he knew of the history of that area, the massacre history, but also some of the cultural history of that area, and what Douglas Grant had he kind of grown to adulthood in those nations, you know, what life might have been like for him. And we do a little tour around some of the places that that Douglas Grant, if he'd grown up there, would have known well, some of the kind of the ceremony grounds and some of the other Bora grounds that are would have been carved out of the rainforest when Douglas Grant was growing up. So that all took a kind of long time to kind of get our heads around. We were also in Berlin trying to go through the archives of the Royal Prussian Phonographic Commission, who kept archives of everything, and there was also the Berlin Ethnographic Society that was interviewing all of these people that were in the camps as part of their anthropological study. So I was really desperate to find material of Douglas Grant from those times. And I did manage to find a few photographs and a sculpture that was made of him by one of Germany's leading sculptors at the time, a guy called Rudolf Marcuse. And Marcuse sculpted Douglas Grant. So I often think that that Douglas Grant's kind of one of those kind of Forrest Gump sort of characters. He brings together all these other famous figures. So Douglas Grant probably met Franz Ferdinand when Franz Ferdinand came out to Australia in the 1890s. And Ferdinand looked in the Australian Museum at all the taxidermy that Douglas Grant's foster father, Robert Grant, would have produced. And maybe Douglas Grant was wheeled out in front of Franz Ferdinand to meet the great man. So, and Franz Ferdinand, as we know, was the Austrian Archduke that was assassinated in 1914 and sparked the whole of the First World War. So Douglas Grant's got these uncanny connections with Franz Ferdinand. Douglas Grant was probably painted by a guy called Thomas Baumgartner, who became Hitler's favourite painter. Douglas Grant was painted in 1919 by Thomas Baumgartner. And so there's a connection to Hitler, and he was sculpted by Rudolf Marcuse, one of the great sculptors of Germany of the time. And when Douglas Grant came back, he was became a very close friend of Henry Lawson, the writer, who was probably the most famous writer in Australia at the time. So there's all these different connections to Douglas Grant and to some of the most famous events and figures of the time that are really uncanny. So, you know, we kind of have thought of him being this sort of Forrest Gump figure, if only Forrest Gump was an intellectual who could quote Shakespeare and Robbie Burns and play the bagpipes.
Yeah, you just mentioned Douglas Grant's meeting with Henry Lawson, the writer. There's also a passage in the documentary where it is said that Douglas Grant strove to make poetry and literature available to soldiers on the front line.
Douglas Grant was really into literature. Like, there's a man, Leonard Adam, who was an anthropologist professor in Germany, a professor of anthropology, and he came out and he became a professor here in Australia, I think at Melbourne University. Leonard Adam was there in the prisoner of war camp. You know, whenever he kind of came in and Douglas Grant was reading literature, so he loved lots of different writers, and one of his favourite was a British satirist called Jerome K. Jerome. And so Douglas Grant was talking to these professors and saying, well, you know, my dear friend, you might like to read this book by Jerome K. Jerome, and giving him a book of short stories and novels of that guy. And he was reading all of the great Australian poets at that point, Dennis and Lawson and Patterson. And he was reading the anthropologies of early Australian anthropologies, that he had books on that. And so he was a very cultured man of his time, who was across all sorts of different areas of scholarly interest. And so when Leonard Adam, this kind of German anthropologist, came in, he was conversing with him as would, you know, any other sophisticated man of the time. So Leonard Adam found him a very impressive figure.
Now, Tom Murray, before I let you go, what would be your take-home message for our listeners?
Well, I think The Skin of Others is a film about Australian history, and it's a film that casts Australian history in a different light from many of the kind of more triumphant versions of Australian history that we often see. But what I think it does is it points us towards a really significant Australian historical figure, Douglas Grant. We don't know very much about him, or we hadn't known very much about him, and I think we really need to know more about that man. He is a totally extraordinary figure of 19th and 20th century Australia. And where the film leaves us is, I think, also an important moment, important Australian moment at this point. It's about, as the Uluru Statement from the Heart has strongly put, like, how do we come to some kind of makarata, some kind of agreement making about where Australia can be that does justice to our history. It's got enough truth-telling that we allow Australian history to be understood better. But where do we take that? What kind of agreements need to be made in order to make Australia a much stronger place? What's our future dreaming? And the film I think, brings in Uncle Archie Roach and Balang Lewis, who plays Douglas Grant in the film, to think through what is the bridge that we need to cross to get to a more reconciled, stronger, fairer Australia. How do we make that makarata that we need to make in order to heal the wounds of our nation? And actually, as white fellas, I'm a white fella, how do we as white fellas understand what Australian Aboriginal culture, Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait culture has to give, to allow us to expand our idea of what Australia can be? And I think that's where the story ends. So I hope people get a bit out of it.
Now, Tom Murray, writer and director of In the Skin of Others, a movie that's premiering on SBS Movies on Tuesday, January 25 at 7 p.m. I highly encourage our listeners to watch it, as it is highly informative and shines the light on a significant figure in Australian history. Tom Murray, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.